Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 406, an interview with John Loftus, being recorded on April 13th of the year 2003. As we have done in the past, we're going to be speaking with John Loftus, the author of, among other titles, The Belarus Secret and Valhalla's Wake, and in partnership with Mark Ahrens, Unholy Trinity and the Secret War Against the Jews. John, welcome to our airwaves.
Thank you, David.
What I'd like to do would be for you briefly to give a professional history of yourself by way of introduction to younger listeners who might not be familiar with you, your work for the OSI, your security clearance, and how you came to be involved in this line of investigation.
Sure. I worked for the Attorney General of the United States during the Carter and Reagan administrations, and I was assigned to do CIA cases and Nazi war crimes cases. One day I discovered that many of the Nazis I was assigned to prosecute were on the CIA payroll. And the CIA didn't have a clue what was going on. It was one of those Cold War shell games. Then I obtained permission from the intelligence community to be a whistleblower on 60 Minutes, exposed the whole thing, testified before Congress. And ever since then, I've sort of been a charity lawyer for every whistleblower inside U.S. intelligence. I charge my clients a buck apiece, and so I'm the worst paid lawyer in America, but among the better informed. But I had every security clearance in the U.S. and NATO, and so I'm one of the few lawyers that people in the intelligence community can talk to, and my job is to help them get things legally declassified, things that the public really needs to know.
Now, one of the avenues of inquiry that your clients and intelligence contacts helped you with was a lawsuit against someone named Sami Al-Arian. If you could tell us about who he is and what that lawsuit entails.
Sure. About a little more than a year ago, some friends of mine in intelligence community came and said that there were two professors at the University of South Florida here in Tampa, and they were both the ringleaders of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, that they were the ones who were sending all the suicide bombers in Israel. And in fact, one professor, Professor Shala, went to Syria and became the world head of the organization, and tonight he's running around trying to hire suicide bombers and snipers to kill American soldiers in Iraq. The other professor, Sami Al-Arian, was the North American head of the organization. But my friends in the intelligence community said they wanted to prosecute him, but were told they couldn't because it would be too embarrassing to the Saudis. The Saudis were the number one financier of the Islamic Jihad, and they were doing it through cutouts. The Saudis had a whole bunch of charities at 555 Grove Street, Herndon, Virginia, and from that base they were funneling money to Texas to fund Hamas, another terrorist group, and to Florida to fund the Islamic Jihad. Now, my FBI friend showed me videotapes. There's Sami Al-Arian being introduced as head of the Islamic Jihad in America, and which is known in this country as ICP for security reasons. That's the phony charity that Al-Arian set up here to launder the money from the Saudis to pay the Syrians. And the guy introduced him said, now, who will give me $500 to kill a Jew? We have people standing by in Jerusalem ready to go out and stab a Jew. And make your checks out to ICP. And Al-Arian, you know, nodding and smiling, and this whole thing goes on. It's really absolutely incredible, the amount of evidence they had. So what I immediately did was to write checks to ICP and made my own donations. Under Florida law, I would then sue ICP to find out whether my money was going to terrorism. So before I could file the lawsuit, I asked everybody in CIA, FBI, all the alphabet agencies to give me every file they had on Sami Al-Arian. And so I wrote up this very lengthy complaint, and under the rules, because of my very high-level security clearances I used to have, I submitted the complaint to CIA for clearance, saying, it's full of classified information. If you want me to take it out, just let me know. The CIA loved it. They said, go ahead and file it. Everybody in Washington is sick of the cover-up of the Saudi funding of terrorism. The FBI came to my door a couple of days later saying, hey, how'd you find out this stuff? There are only 21 people in the U.S. government that knew some of this information, and now you're number 22. I said, sorry, I can't tell you, attorney-client privilege. The day I went before to file the complaint, I got a frantic call from the Justice Department begging me to give them more time. They really were going to raid the Saudi terrorist charity headquarters in Virginia. I said, yep, that's what you told me in January, and again in February. Now it's March. You want more time? I'll give you more time. I'll give you to 4 o'clock tomorrow. I'm going to file my complaint at 10, and I will embargo the Herndon, Virginia address until 4 o'clock, then I'm releasing it to the press, along with the facts that you guys haven't bothered to raid this place in 10 years. So I filed my complaint at 10 o'clock, and at 11 o'clock, the U.S. government launched Operation GreenQuest, a massive raid of the Saudi charities in Virginia in their homes, and they seized all sorts of computer records and documents that really have seriously implicated the Saudi royal family in laundering money for terrorism. The Saudis are even claiming tax deductions for terrorism. So the Operation Green Quest raid on the hour after I filed my complaint really has launched several other indictments nationwide to bring down the other members of the money laundering network. So in a single day, you know, we effectively shut down the entire Saudi money laundering network in America. So I'm kind of proud of that.
Well, you should be. And let me, on behalf of the human race, the American people, and myself in particular, offer hearty congratulations.
You know, the ones I feel most badly for the Palestinians, because the Saudis were terrified that the Palestinian peace agreement would work and that there would be an independent Palestinian state. It would probably be a democracy. And so the Saudis were afraid that any Arab democracy would be a threat to their kingdom. So the Saudis were pumping money through their murder-for-hire pipeline to hire these really extreme groups like Islamic Jihad. And every time the peace process got close, the Saudis would send suicide bombers through Sami Alarian to wreck the peace process. Very effective, very cynical strategy.
There are a number of questions that I have about the failure of the Oslo Accords, and in particular, some speculative lines of inquiry that I had. I don't know if even necessarily if we want to take time in this interview.
Well, just in 10 seconds, the Oslo Accords came in a brief lull. The Soviet Union used to fund terrorism in the Middle East, and they collapsed, and no one was funding for a while. And that's when the Oslo Agreements came up. And then the Saudis picked up all the old communist terrorist groups and started to fund them. So if you want to stop terrorism in the world, you have to tell the Saudis to stop funding it. So I have a way of doing that. Right after I filed the Sami Alarian lawsuit, I rounded up 41 of the top lawyers in America and brought them down to St. Pete and said, look, the same Saudi charities and banks that funded Sami Alarian, they also funded Al-Qaeda.
Really?
The Saudis have been paying $100 million a year to Al-Qaeda to stay out of Saudi Arabia, go blow up someone else. Well, that was negligent. The Saudis should have realized that sooner or later, America would be someone else. Mm-hmm. And indeed, on September 11th, we were. So what I asked these lawyers to do, I said, I'll work for free. I'll provide all the evidence and round up all the experts. But I want you to put up millions of dollars. I want you to sue the Saudi royal family on behalf of all the victims of 9/11. And on August 15th last year in federal court in Washington, my friends filed a $1 trillion lawsuit against the Saudi royal family, the Saudi banks, and the Saudi charities on behalf of 3,000-plus victims of 9/11. It's the largest class action in American history. And every intelligence agency in the world is sending us files. The evidence is overwhelming.
And you are actually functioning as the intelligence advisor for this relatively well-publicized lawsuit.
Oh, yeah.
Off the cuff, John, there has been a lot of discussion in the major news media about reluctance of the Bush administration, or at least elements of the Bush administration, to proceed with the lawsuit. There has been rumination about various possible motives, embarrassing the Saudis, thereby weakening the war on terror. What's your take on the Bush administration's attitude toward the lawsuit and investigation of 9/11 in general? If you're in a position to discuss that.
Well, yeah, what's going on is that there's a civil war inside the White House, okay? On one side is Condoleezza Rice and the progressives, and they're telling the president, look, you know, we have to separate ourselves from your father's oil crowd. You know, your dad made a huge mistake in Iraq. He made mistakes all over the place. We have to do the right thing. Now, I'm a Democrat, but I actually really like this president. He's not the sharpest tool in the shed, but I think he's got his heart in the right place. And he's got good advisors. I think Condoleezza Rice is one of the brightest people in the world. I'm really impressed by her. So I think what's happened is that it's a real awkward situation because if this goes down to fruition, President Bush might be in a position of someday having to indict his own dad.
That's interesting. And again, off the cuff, John, one of the things that I was noting in connection with the 320-2002 Green Quest raid stemming from your lawsuit was that one of the institutions, they have not been indicted as far as I know, but one of the institutions and part of the milieu that overlap those are Grover Norquist, the Islamic Institute, and people who are not only very much connected with this administration's role in its program of cutting taxes, but also the Islamic Institute overlaps the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization, which, as you've written about so much, has a very interesting background indeed.
Oh, yeah, there's a real war among lobbyists. Grover Norquist is sort of been characterized in the press as some kind of right-wing bully who represents the Arabian oil producers,
mm-hmm.
even to the point of protecting terrorist investigations. One of the things I'm most concerned about is, why didn't we indict Sami Alarian back in 1989 when we first learned he was a terrorist? And everyone's telling me it's because, you know, we want to let the Saudis alone. Even Ollie North, in his biography, wrote, every time I try to do something about terrorism in the Middle East, I was told to stop because it would embarrass the Saudis. The most poignant story is about another Irishman like me, John O'Neill. John was the Al-Qaeda expert in the FBI, and he went all around Washington saying, look, the Saudis are funding every terrorist group in the world. Everything you want to know about Saudis, about terrorism, is in Saudi Arabia. And they're funding this guy, Osama bin Laden, and he is coming after us. There will be terrorism. There will be a terrible price to pay. And they all sort of patted him on the head and said, hey, look, the Saudis are selling us oil at a discount. You know, they may be funding terrorism, but they're only killing Jews and not killing Americans. Well, John O'Neill quit the FBI in disgust. 2 weeks later, he was at his new job. John was chief of security at the Twin Trade Towers and died in the attack. So now you know why I'm getting so many FBI guys coming forward to give me some information.
Another off-the-cuff question, John. I've noted John O'Neill's role in investigating the Bin Laden organization and his charges of active frustration of that investigation by powerful...
Well, yeah, the Bin Laden family were partners with President Bush in the Carlyle Group, the most pro-Saudi lobbying group in Washington and the most influential. And it was a hideous embarrassment because here's President Bush and the executive branch trying to hunt down terrorism, and the Bin Laden family are partners with his dad.
It was really interesting to me to note one of the things that emerged in the American mainstream media just prior to September 11th. John O'Neill had a briefcase. It was revealed after he resigned the FBI that he had a briefcase stolen in Tampa in the summer of 2000 that detailed every counterintelligence and counterterror operation in
New York.
No,
that's not true. That wasn't in the briefcase.
Oh, okay. So that was a New York Times piece of disinformation or misinformation.
Misinformation, yeah.
Okay.
No, it just wasn't true. O'Neill left the briefcase with some friends he thought in the FBI while he was attending a seminar. He came back.
Right.
And somehow the briefcase was gone.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just an attempt to get rid of O'Neill. That's all.
I see. Because the New York Times of 8/19/2001.
Yeah, the New York Times and several New York magazines all beat up on O'Neill, and it was totally, totally unjustified.
Oh, so it was basically just aimed at moving him out.
Discrediting him, yeah. He was a guy who was threatening to become a whistleblower.
Okay.
And they had to smear his reputation. That's all.
Okay.
The FBI didn't want to know if I had been in contact with O'Neill, you know?
Okay. Well, thanks for clearing that up for us. One of the things that I was wondering about, again, this is just pure rumination. We're talking about the Carlyle Group and reactionary versus progressives within, or relative progressives within the Bush administration. And I know Grover Norquist was cited by several people in discussion of the Islamic Institute as wanting to recruit Muslim Americans as a possible counterweight to the traditional Jewish Democratic support or Jewish support for the Democratic Party. I noted there's a book just out about the Carlyle Group called The Iron Triangle, and it mentions that although his role with the group was only very brief, that Fred Malek, the Nixon administration guy, had actually set up many of Carlyle's key Washington contacts. And, of course, Fred Malek has a background with some of the same people that you wrote about in The Secret War Against the Jews. Some of the old fascist freedom fighters were brought in. Do you think that anti-Semitism and this schism within the administration possibly played a role in some of this?
Yeah, I think what it is, I don't think that the elder President Bush is an anti-Semite. I think he's extremely anti-Israel. As I mentioned in my book, when the Israelis blew up the Oserak reactor in Iraq, Vice President Bush then went to President Reagan saying, look, we've got to bomb Israel in retaliation, blow up the air base at least, because, you know, Saddam Hussein is our friend and he's selling us all his oil. So it's not anti-Semitism. It's really about the money. You know, when you boil all this down, you know, history is not biography. History is not ideology. History is economy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's all about how do we squeeze the most money in the shortest possible time, or how do we balance efficiency with ethics.
In other words, realpolitik, spelled R-I-Y-A-L.
Yeah.
Of course, that's a Saudi unit of currency for younger members of the audience. Real quickly, some of can you tell us about some of the key names who are defendants in this lawsuit that's ongoing?
I don't want to talk too much about the lawsuit, but
okay.
You know, the names of the defendants are listed there. But It's Prince Sultan, Prince Abdullah. There's a lot of guys there. These are effectively the senior members of the Saudi royal family.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest, I told them to hire Jean-Charles Brizard as one of our experts, because Jean-Charles had reviewed all the French intelligence files on Saudi funding of terrorism and had written a good book about it, including interviewing, among others, John O'Neill. So I think it's a powerful, powerful piece of litigation. I don't think the government is going to stop it.
All righty. And we noted in a recent broadcast, this was something that I've discussed with my audience, that Khalid bin Mahfouz has now filed a lawsuit against Jean-Charles Brizard. It remains to be seen what happens with that. John, first of all, if you would give us your website, the URL for your website, in which you have a number of interesting
information.
Oh, I'd be
delighted. It's www.john-loftus.com. That's J-O-H-N hyphen, not underscore. Loftus, LOFTUS.com, John-Loftus.com.
And
I do all this stuff pro bono, so if people want to make donations, there's a little donation box on the website.
Fantastic. That was my next question, because if people would like to help out, and I know many people feel frustrated with the events of September 11th and would like to do something, this is something they can do.
Yeah, well, we're having a little bit of fun. Of course, Sami Alarian was indicted a month ago. The Saudi lawsuit is proceeding wonderfully, and there's lots of other things that sprung off that I can't talk about, but we're making a lot of headway into some of the terrorist cells in America and around the world.
John, one of the articles you talk about on your website, it's actually on your website, is a very thought-provoking article about Enron and the proposed pipeline deal running across Afghanistan and a role that connection may have played in September 11th. Can you detail that for us?
Sure. Just to give you the headlines, that essentially American oil companies believe that there'd be a huge oil strike in the Caspian Basin, an area that borders Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan. But in order for the America to get the oil out, we would have to build a pipeline across Afghanistan to Pakistan in order to hit the coast. Well, the Clinton administration didn't want to hear about a pipeline. They realized that Osama bin Laden was our enemy. In fact, Clinton launched a strike of 20 cruise missiles trying to take him out and banned any American oil company from having contact with the Taliban. Well, that put Enron in a lot of trouble, because Enron was the company that did all the research on the pipeline feasibility. Enron thought it was such a great idea. They were stealing all their money out of the U.S. and buying up land lease oil exploration rights in Kazakhstan. And they also built a huge energy plant in India, the Gopal plant, that would never be economically profitable unless the pipeline were built. So when Clinton said no more deals in Afghanistan, Enron was ruined. When the Bush administration came through, the Enron people approached Vice President Cheney. Now, Dick Cheney's sort of a nice guy, but he's got, a lot of ties with the oil industry. And Enron said, look, Dick, you got to do us a favor. We have to negotiate with the Taliban to build a pipeline. All we need is to sign this document that the Caspian Bay Initiative is the number one priority in oil energy exploration. And Cheney did sign that document. But all the relating documents with the Enron discussions have been withheld from Congress and from the GAO. They haven't turned them over. But Cheney made a stupid mistake. His friends tricked him. What the Enron people were doing, not just the Enron people, a lot of oil companies were saying, look, the Saudis are our partners. We don't want anything to embarrass the Saudis for the next 9 months. So leading up until September 11th, the word went around the senior bureaucrats in Washington, don't do anything that's going to embarrass the Saudis right now. We're trying to put together a deal. This could be wonderful for America, solve our energy problems for the next 20 years. It's the new Alaska, blah, blah, blah. And so every time that the good folks, and there are a lot of good folks in CIA and FBI, tried to work on terrorism cases, for some reason, warrants were never issued. More evidence was needed. Alarian was never prosecuted. The Saudi things were never raided. It went on and on and on. And so my sources tell me that because of the Taliban pipeline negotiations, America was made blind for about 9 months leading up till September 11th.
These negotiations were actually, according to the information on your website, known to Mohammed Attaf, the now deceased operations chief for Al-Qaeda.
Sure. I have one of my friends got an emails off Mohammed Attaf's computer, in which he summarized how the Taliban pipeline negotiations were going. So obviously the Taliban were much more loyal to Mohammed Atta than they were to the idea of getting rich over the pipeline. You know, the clumsy U.S. proxies for the oil companies were saying, well, look, we'll give you a carpet of gold or a carpet of bombs. Well, the Taliban chose the one. They chose the carpet of bombs. While the pipeline negotiations were going on, they were helping al-Qaeda prepare for the Twin Trade Tower strike.
By the way, it's Mohammed Atef, I believe, wasn't it? The
Atef, A-T-E-F. Yes.
Right, right. Another fascinating article on your website, John, that follows up on some of the information that you present in The Secret War Against the Jews concerns the Thyssen-Bornemisza Industrial Empire and some fascinating disclosures by a former U.S. intelligence agent whose name escapes me offhand, but his father was actually Franklin Delano Roosevelt's liaison with the Vatican.
Bill Gowan, yeah.
Bill Gowan. Can you tell us about the Thyssen-Bornemisza Empire and what that is, basically? Because as important as it is, it's not a name most people know. And
no, this is one of those hidden things in history. Teddy Roosevelt was the great trustbuster. He said, you know, no more monopolies, no more cartels. Well, the robber barons didn't like that, so they asked Congress to pass a loophole law. It's called the Webb-Pomeroy Act of 1918, and it says they could build cartels and monopolies overseas. So in the early 1920s, these guys decided that they would take over friendly dictators who would let them establish cartels. So they pumped a ton of money into Germany, Bolshevik Russia, and they helped found the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
John, very quickly, I'd never heard of this. How is that spelled? I'm taking notes here. Webb, Carmeline?
W-E-B-B hyphen Pomerine, I believe, is P-O-M-E-R-E-I-N-E.
Okay, thank you. And that was 1918?
Yep.
All righty, thank you. Now we're talking about the funding of dictators overseas post-World War I. Proceed, thanks.
Well, I mean, in Germany, you know, Germany was almost bankrupt after World War I. They were cash-starved. But Germany did have a tremendous amount of industrial patents. They had coal fields, they had steel mills, and a lot of hard assets on the ground. So Wall Street investors said, look, we'll buy into this company and many other German companies. 70% of the money that went to rebuild the industry of the Third Reich came from Wall Street and the rest from Britain. I mean, this was money coming at a crucial time. Now, the Thyssen family was very upset that they lost a lot of their holdings to the French in World War I. So they wanted to set up a scheme where no matter which side would win the next war, the Thyssen Company would survive. So they set up a series of banks, one in Wall Street, one in Amsterdam, and one in Berlin. And, of course, all the banks were cross-collateralized. Now, the American partners were a Democrat named Harriman and a Republican named Herbert Walker, who was the great-grandfather of the current president of the United States. And Herbert Walker put his son-in-law, Prescott Bush, as the executive officer of these companies, including the banks. So Prescott Bush may not have realized it at first, but he was the senior officer of Nazi front companies in the U.S. In fact, Prescott Bush's companies were seized by the U.S. in 1942 for the right thing for the wrong reason. They thought that these companies were owned by the Dutch. The Dutch bank supposedly controlled the American bank, the Union Banking Corporation. But in fact, they were all Nazi funds, and a lot of people in the U.S. suspected them. But sure enough, when the war was over, all the ownership documents were transferred from Berlin to the Dutch bank, the neutral bank, and they were able to reclaim the properties, and Thyssen-Bornemisza survived the war intact and is now known as the Thyssen-Krupp Corporation, the wealthiest conglomerate in Europe. So it's really a tragedy, but, you know, President Bush's grandfather was a guy who was a winning tool of the Nazis in the U.S.
Krupp, by the way,
my Republican friends may hate that, but it's the truth.
Yeah, one of the problems with this line of investigation is ideologization, and I know I often alienate both right-wingers and left-wingers. There's an old Turkish proverb, he who tells the truth gets chased out of nine villages. And,
here we go.
I suspect it's
it isn't about ideology, it's about the money. I mean, these guys that invested, they didn't care about the Bolsheviks, they didn't care about Nazism, they didn't care about Wahhabism in Saudi Arabia. They just wanted to set up cartels. It was all about the money.
It was, and apparently to a certain extent still is. By the way,
that's what's different about this President Bush. I hope people don't blame him for what his grandfather did anymore. They blame Jack Kennedy for what his father did. Jack Kennedy's dad invested a lot of Nazi stocks. What people don't know is that it seems he bought those Nazi stocks from Prescott Bush.
Really?
Yeah, they took a cruise together to Germany. That apparently was the time when Prescott sold Joe Kennedy on the inevitable victory of the Third Reich.
And when John F. Kennedy, when he was a student, actually wrote a thesis, Why England Slept, and it was believed by some that he would follow in his father's footsteps. But his father, actually, I believe FDR replaced him as ambassador to the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
Precisely because
FDR yanked him.
By the way, if people want to read about some of the deep history and deep politics surrounding macroeconomics and corporate connections between the fascist dictatorships of Europe and the American elite, The Secret War Against the Jews, co-authored by my guest John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, is a remarkable work. John, we're almost at the end of this side of the interview. Let me just fire a quick off-the-cuff question. Talking about getting chased out of nine villages, I've been a tireless exponent of your work, and in particular The Secret War Against the Jews, which I've never seen a single book with so much of the information that I've been researching between those two covers, and yet it seems to have dropped off the radar screen.
The book is still selling strongly. Showtime is actually thinking of making a TV series out of it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Fantastic. I know that there's a softcover edition which I still see around. Is it still in print or has it been remaining?
No, it's still in print. It's still selling strongly.
So people can order that at their bookstores.
Sure, Amazon carries it. Yeah.
Fantastic. That book again is called The Secret War Against the Jews, subtitled How Western Intelligence Betrayed the Jewish People, co-authored by my guest John Loftus and Mark Ahrens. Softcover edition, St. Martin's Press, copyright 1994, and I don't know the ISBN number offhand, but it is a good read and a remarkable, remarkable piece of history. John, we're almost out of time on this side of the interview. I'd like to continue with your remarkable and frankly, heroic research. Very quickly, once again, give us your website, and through this website, people can make donations to your efforts.
And they can keep current on the projects I'm working on. It's www.john-loftus.com.
And once again, let me remind you that the various broadcasts that I've done over the years are available from Spitfire. You can reach them at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. You can email them at mail@spitfirelist.com. Visit the Real Audio-equipped Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. And there will be a detailed annotated description of For the Record 406 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website within a week or so of the airing of this broadcast. And sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, right across the river from Ground Zero, where the World Trade Center used to be, is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs, including eventually this broadcast, at WFMU.org/Dave Emery. Older programs at a longer URL on Real Audio for download only. Link to the WFMU.org/Dave Emery website and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website, and it is all free. Once again, I have been visiting with John Loftus, the author of several titles by himself and others, with Mark Ahrens, and a pivot point in many of the legal investigations into the events in and around September 11th and Middle Eastern terrorism. John, I'd like to continue with your fascinating heroic work in the second side of this broadcast.
Well, thank you, David. Don't get this kind of attention at home, you know.
Well, you're getting it here and on the other stations that air it. For John Loftus, this is Dave Emery saying this is the conclusion of Side 1 of For the Record 406, being recorded on April 13th of 2003. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for Side 2.